From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Emerging artist bumper music for the first couple hours tonight, and later on tonight, a look at the spiritual side. Here's what's happening. House Democrats believe they have the 217 votes needed to pass articles of impeachment against President Trump, stemming from his Ukraine call. Enough votes to impeach Mr. Trump and send the articles to the Senate even before their planned hearings or formal investigation. And a second whistleblower has now come forward with information about President Donald Trump's dealings with the Ukraine, adding to the impeachment peril, engulfing the White House, and potentially providing new leads to Democrats in their unfurling investigation of Mr. Trump's conduct. Howard Bloom, the expert and author of The Global Brain, with us. Howard, I want your update on how you think the week has gone and what you think the week ahead will show.
Well, it's pretty amazing. Here's the news. Whistleblower number one, whose complaint was revealed almost 2 weeks ago, said that President Donald Trump is endangering the nation's security and undermining our ability to protect our elections. Specifically, whistleblower number one said that President Trump withheld $400 million voted by Congress for defense of the Ukraine against Russian invaders. The president's goal, says the whistleblower, was to force the Ukrainian presidents, in the whistleblower's words, to play ball. Republicans argue that this first whistleblower is a deep state Democrat operative whose report is based on hearsay and is false. But the accusation of falseness has proven this week not to be true. The White House itself released a summary of President Trump's July 25th phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. And in that summary, Donald Trump very specifically says that he will release $400 million in aid appropriated by Congress if Zelensky does him a favor. That favor is investigating Joe and Hunter Biden and a company called CrowdStrike, a computer security and consultancy firm that has worked for both Republicans and Democrats. In the White House's summary of President Trump's July 25th phone call, one thing is clear. The whistleblower's description of Trump's phone call with Ukraine was uncannily accurate. And today it was announced that, as you said, there's a second whistleblower with even closer involvement in the president's phone calls who is ready to corroborate the claims of the first. Meanwhile, a string of text messages released this week showed, in the words of CBS News, that U.S. diplomats spent weeks pushing Ukraine to open investigations into the Bidens and CrowdStrike. And a few days ago, the president called on China to investigate the Bidens on national TV. Now, how this looks depends on where you stand. If you are a Republican, you probably believe that the Bidens are corrupt and must be investigated. And you may well believe that the Clintons colluded with the Ukrainians to rig the 2016 presidential election, a theory that President Donald Trump is pushing. If the Clinton collusion theory is true, investigating CrowdStrike could finally reveal Clinton criminality. And it could also produce a missing Clinton computer server that the pushers of this conspiracy theory say that CrowdStrike hid in the Ukraine. But where does the Clinton collusion theory come from? There's a clue. This theory says that Russia was not the villain in our 2016 election. The Ukraine was. So the source may well be Russia. In other words, President Donald Trump may be pushing a phony Russian conspiracy theory designed to get Russia off the hook for election interference, another development in the Ukraine scandal took place this week. Former Trump friend and former Trump White House communications director Anthony Scaramucci accused President Donald Trump of treason. That's a Republican saying this. And this morning, Republican candidate for President Joe Walsh said the same thing on CNN. Now, are these accusations accurate? Has the president done anything treasonous? One of the first whistleblower's key concerns was that the president was harsh on allies like British Prime Minister Theresa May and obsequious in phone calls with totalitarian leaders. The first whistleblower's particular concern was Donald Trump's behavior on the phone with Vladimir Putin. And the whistleblower was not alone. To quote the Washington Examiner from just 2 days ago, President Trump was obsequious and fawning with Putin. These words, say the Examiner, came from a former White House official. But where's the treason? President Donald Trump has been doing Vladimir Putin's dirty work. President Trump demanded that the Ukrainian president investigate CrowdStrike to clear Russia's name. The same thing happened in a conversation just revealed between President Trump and British Prime Minister Theresa May. In March of 2018, a Russian who had spied for the West and gone into exile in England, Sergei Skripal, was poisoned along with his daughter. nearly every intelligence expert in the world said the poisoning was done by Russia. Even the poison used was uniquely Russian. But to quote the Washington Examiner on the phone with the British Prime Minister, President Trump, quote, disputed the conclusion by British intelligence that the Kremlin was behind the poisoning, close quote. Again, President Trump was doing Vladimir Putin's dirty work. So are the favors Donald Trump has done for Vladimir Putin treason, or are they just wise and disruptive foreign policy? George Washington had the last word on this in his farewell address. He said, against the insidious wiles of foreign influence, the jealousy of a free people ought to be constantly awake. He added that a passionate attachment of one nation for another gives to ambitious, corrupted, or deluded citizens facility to betray or sacrifice the interests of their own country, sometimes even with popularity.
Howard, what I think will probably happen is I think they'll get it to a trial. I do not think they'll convict in the Senate. That's just my guess. We'll find out. We'll talk to you this week. Howard Bloom. A man has been charged with murder and the deaths of four homeless men in Chinatown in New York. 24-year-old Randy Santos has been charged with four counts of murder and one count of attempted murder. Santos, who is also homeless, was arrested shortly after four men were discovered dead on various streets of Chinatown early in the morning. Investigators say the victims were sleeping on the street, vulnerable and unsuspecting. That's when police say he beat their heads repeatedly with a pipe with so much force that four of them died at the scene. A fifth victim was also severely hurt. Wow, strange story there. Two men opened fire inside a bar in Kansas City, Kansas, early Sunday, killing four people and wounding five others in a shooting believed to have stemmed from an earlier dispute. Authorities are searching for the two gunmen now, according to a police spokesman. He said the two men had apparently gotten into some kind of disagreement with people inside the Tequila KC bar, left, then returned with the guns. Want to be miserable? Just three states offer an array of places you may like. Business leaders and insiders released a list of 50 of the most miserable cities in America, with cities in California, 10 of them, New Jersey, 9, Florida, 6, accounting for half of the list. In compiling its rankings, Business Insider said it used U.S. Census information to analyze 1,000 U.S. cities, such as crime, drug addiction, population changes, job opportunities, commute times, etc. It decided that, here we go, Gary, Indiana, just outside of Chicago, was the nation's most miserable city, followed by Port Arthur, Texas, and then my hometown of Detroit. How about that? Talks for a new four-year labor contract between General Motors and its striking workers took a turn for the worse on Sunday after the UAW rejected the largest U.S. automaker's latest offer, but the two sides are still talking. Our registered investment advisor, Mish Shedlock, with us. Mish, we got to get this thing settled.
My gosh, George, talks are breaking down all over the place. Let's talk about GM first. Now, one of the big disputes is over layoffs and plants. The thing is, George, we're going to electric cars. It's sooner or later. I believe sooner, but eventually it's going to happen. Electric cars require way fewer parts and 30% less people to make. The union's demanding that GM keep all these plants open. How can it do it? Its bonds are still at junk status.
Yep.
If it gives in too much, they're going to push this to junk. We're going to have another bailout, George. They need to talk this through. Speaking of talks, let's look at what's going on. Trump has these negotiations going on with China right now. Those things broke through this weekend because Trump is demanding China discuss everything at once. No matter what you believe about this or which side is right, when you lay that red line down there like that, that it's all or nothing, China's backing away. And the third major talk that's breaking down globally, Boris Johnson and the EU have been discussing things. The EU firmed up and said, you know, I'm sorry, even though you gave on your last offer, it's not good enough. You have to give more. There's a third place where I would prefer decides to sit down and have a discussion. George, what's going on? Nobody wants to deal, despite claiming they all want a deal.
We got to get it done. And then with GM, 48,000 workers idled. Mish, thanks. We'll talk to you this week, too, as we watch this story unfold. Rip Taylor, the exuberant comedian whose zany shtick and over-the-top delivery made him a television and nightclub mainstay for more than six decades, has died. He was 84 years old, died in his home in Beverly Hills. He was funny. The Joker movie came out over the weekend. Huge, $93.5 million domestically, and overseas, $140 million. Unbelievable. I'm predicting that Joaquin Phoenix, who plays the Joker, will win an Oscar for his performance on this. Let's see what happens when that comes. Have you ever wondered why teams win? Good teams in business, sport, and beyond? In a moment, Dr. Saul Miller joins us. We're going to talk about why teams win next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about our special guests for the first couple hours. Dr. Saul Miller, a performance specialist consulting in sport, business, healthcare, and the arts, PhD in clinical psychology. Dr. Miller, one of North America's leading mental coaches. We'll talk about that in a moment. His work in the areas of enhancing performance and team building has helped organizations, individuals, teams be very successful while dealing effectively with stress and pressure. Over the past 25 years, Dr. Miller's clients have included sports teams in the NFL, the NBA, NHL, Canadian Football League, Major League Baseball, PGA, NCAA athletes, Olympians as well. He has business clients, including Kraft, Motorola, and so many others. And here he is with his book, Why Teams Win, 9 Keys to Success in Business, Sport, and Beyond. Dr. Saul, welcome to the program.
A pleasure to be with you, George.
I'm looking forward to this. And this is a very different topic. I got excited with this because I haven't done this before.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
How did you get involved in this?
Well, that's interesting. Many years ago, I was teaching at Mississippi State, and I ran the counseling center. And my next-door neighbor, who at the time I didn't know, was a fellow named Jim Poling, who was just out of the Army. He was a tennis coach, and he told me they had been doing some mind enhancement work. He was an officer in the Army, and wanted me to do some work with the tennis team. And we started with tennis. We had a lot of success, went on to golf, went on to baseball. One of the guys on the baseball team tied an NCAA record for most home runs in a single season. And it just one thing led to the next. We had a lot of success. And Davey Johnson, who used to manage who went on to manage the New York Mets.
That's right.
Was managing a double-A team in Jackson, Mississippi. And he was real curious to know, what did you do with this guy to give him a 300% performance increment? So Davey and I connected, and then, 2 years later, I was working with the New York Mets, and we went on to win the World Series.
Do you deal with the mind? Is it is it the physical part of the body, or do you do it, or is it all encompassing?
No, we're working really with helping people to be more positive, more powerful, and especially to be in the present. I'm dealing mostly with emotion and thought, so I'm really dealing with the mind and the spirit. And when people are anxious, George, they're worrying about the future. When they get frustrated, they're really focused on the past. And the power is in the present. The power is now. So how do you get people into this state of being totally now? And we work with breath and thought and imagery and a variety of different techniques.
Do you find that a good, let's just use sports as an example here, because we can guide the winning and losing that way. It's mm-hmm. easier. That a good manager can motivate his players much like you do when you're training people?
Well, a good manager has a lot of things on his plate. And sometimes their focus should be on enhancing everybody's performance, but they've got to move the big ship forward. And sometimes it's really helpful to have somebody else who's really working with the individual, mm-hmm. helping that individual to be more focused, to have more emotional control.
Can you take an average player who has an average ability and make that person a winner as compared to, let's say, somebody with better abilities who's not into the same thing.
Well, I think it's possible that somebody with average talent and an absolute commitment who really works on their mental game can lift themselves above a performer, and it could be in the arts as well, who has considerable talent but really doesn't have that ability to focus and control their emotions properly.
I think you're right. I've seen so many people, Dr. Miller, who are very talented at what they do, but they aren't motivated to make it happen. They're either lazy or they don't believe in themselves, and they fall short all the time.
Well, absolutely. I'm often telling athletes, you know, I mean, most of the people I'm working with are elite, and I say most of you know people who were talented but didn't actually believe in themselves and didn't achieve as much as people with less talent who really thought, I'm going to make it happen.
I had a friend, God rest his soul, and there's a reason for that God rest his soul part, who was relatively talented and he was a ring announcer for sports events and things like that. But he never thought of himself as being good. He would be subjected to panic attacks when he went in the middle of a ring. He would fumble and bumble when he was very good, when he wasn't doing it. And he just always got down on himself. And consequently, he died of a prescription overdose of medication, which I think contributed to his total feeling.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're talking to elite athletes who really excel, most of them would tell you that they love the pressure. I mean, it enhances performance.
Right.
And I have a belief system that whatever comes up, if your goal is to be the best you can be, but if whatever comes up, you've got to find a way to use it. And if you're performing in a theater of pressure, you have to learn how to really be an expert to embrace it.
Is it easy?
I think one thought that I have is that the core human emotions are love and fear. And when we have love, we expand, we move into it, bring it on. I love it. Let's make it happen. When we have fear, we contract. And with fear, you know, we have tension. It interrupts our flow. It interrupts our breath. And we start to think thoughts like don't fail or don't mess up. And when we love something, we just move into it.
What's easier for you as an instructor, as a performance psychologist, to teach a group or to teach the individual?
Well, it's easier in a way to work one-on-one. It's easier to work with the individual. However, I honestly think I prefer working with groups because a team is like a family. And there's a certain energy when you come into it. And, you want to get that group. It's like singing in a choir. If you're singing in a choir and then you're quiet for a moment and that choir is singing, there's an energy that just carries you along. And it's really exciting to be involved with a team, with a group of people who are committed to really excelling, achieving something extraordinary.
I mean, I'd love for you to work with my Detroit Tigers. They had the worst season they've ever had this year. It would be a great guide to be able to look at what they could do. Because, my God, they can't do any worse than they did this year.
Well, I mean, make it happen, and I'll be there next season.
Make some calls for you. Jeez. But I have a guest who comes on the program every once in a while. His name is Dr. Joseph Gallenberger. Mm-hmm. And he does what he calls tests on performance of a positive and negative. He takes groups of students to Las Vegas. And in one group, they're upbeat and happy and excited all the time. The other group is depressed and down and negative. And he says every time the group that is upbeat and excited wins, the group that is negative loses all the time. It's amazing.
Well, I think we do create our reality, and I'd certainly believe that. Love is power, and if I love to play, let's do it. You know, I'm feeling great. Then I think exceptional things can happen.
Dr. Saul Miller's website is his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He's got a couple books out there. One is called Performing Under Pressure. We'll talk about that a little bit later on when we take calls. And also Why Teams Win, 9 Keys to Success in Business, Sport, and Beyond. We're going to come back and talk with him more about some of the techniques he uses to make a person or a group a winner. And in the meantime, go like us over there at Facebook, follow us on Twitter, email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. It's simple as that. Halloween, about 25 days away. Participate in the program. What we also do during Ghost to Ghost is take a number of phone calls, including some that you have sent in to us with great ghost stories, Tom.
Absolutely correct. Thursday, October 31st, Halloween coming up. Email us your best ghost stories. Tell us the ones you have, the scariest ones. We might just call you back and let you tell it on air that night. All you got to do is go to ghoststories@coasttocoastam.com. Make sure to include your phone number and your best ghost story, ghoststories@coasttocoastam.com.
And we will be back with Dr. Saul Miller as we talk about why teams win next on Coast to Coast AM. And George Norrie back with you with Dr. Saul Miller. Dr. Miller, when teams or individuals come to you, why are they coming to you? Are they obviously not winning? What is their issue?
The goal is simply to perform at the best. I mean, sometimes, yeah, I would say generally people are, yeah, something's not quite right. They're not exactly excelling. But oftentimes, you know, I'm approached by a team before the season even begins, because there's a perception that if the players, if the team as a group have better focus, have more emotional control, have some skills to mentally prepare, they're going to be more effective. Basically, it comes down to people performing at their best.
Is there a common denominator with winners and losers, something that you spot right away?
Well, I think, as I said, people who are most effective are positive. They're totally in the present. I think they have a passion for what they do, and they have the ability to regulate their emotional intensity and stay positive, stay totally in the present. It's interesting. I could ask the listeners to imagine this. I had a situation some years ago where I'm working with a baseball team. They're playing in the World Series. One of the players that I had worked with all year comes up to the plate. It's a 10th inning. His team is losing the game 5-3. They're losing the series 3-2. The bottom line is there's two out. If he makes an out, his team has lost the World Series.
Yep, the season's over for them.
Exactly. There's 60,000 people in the stadium, 60, 70 million watching on television. And I ask clients sometimes, what could you do at that moment to be at your best? And interestingly, with this player, we had worked all season on a couple of things. One was we worked a lot with breathing. I do a lot of work with breathing to help people regulate emotional intensity.
Mm-hmm. Good idea.
And the second thing we worked with was transforming one thought from, I've got to get a hit, which is pressure and tension, to I love to hit the ball. And of course, he got a hit, or I wouldn't tell the story, and they ended up winning the game, going on to game 7, in which case he got a home run, and he ended up winning the car for the MVP in the World Series. But it was just being able, under pressure, to take a breath, think, I love to hit the ball, rather than tensing up, which slows you down mm-hmm. and just creates a, you know, don't miss, don't fail mindset.
When you've talked about 9 keys to success in business, in sport and beyond, want to rattle them off real quickly for us?
Sure. Absolutely. The first key is really meaningful purpose. I think healthy people want to excel. They want to be part of something special. And when we have meaningful purpose, we're going to invest more of ourselves in making it happen. The next one is talent. I mean, I think John Madden, the football coach, once said, you know, to be a good coach and win, you have to have good players. But we would also say the team with the best players doesn't always win.
That's true.
But you do need talent. And then, of course, there's leadership, and leadership is really interesting. We can talk more about that, because leadership touches on all the other, on all the 8 keys. And, you know, the head leads and the body follows. And next we have strategy, the game plan. I mean, what is the approach? What do we have to do to be successful? I mean, great football player Merlin Olsen said, we need to know where things are going and how to get there. I mean, what is the strategy? Then we have commitment. And I do a lot of speaking to corporate groups and so on, and I've asked coaches, sport coaches, I've asked business managers, of the 9 keys, which do you think is most important? Of course, they're all important. But the number one they chose is commitment. Are you willing to do what's necessary to achieve your goal? Are you willing to pay the price? And I remember, I think it was Gene Kranz with the space program, where he said, failure is not an option. I mean, we are dialed in. We are going to make this happen. The next one is feedback. If you're going to win, you've got to keep score. So it's how are we doing? We have to know how we're doing, and we have to be able to acknowledge our people for their performance. And then we have confidence. Confidence is huge. If we believe in what we're doing, we're going to perform more effectively. There's chemistry. Chemistry is the flow between the group. It's vitally important in teams. One of my clients once said, a winning team is like a beating heart. And he described being traded from a team that was really struggling to a team that eventually won the cup. And he said, when I walked into the dressing room on that winning team, I could just feel the heartbeat, and I just picked it up.
Yep.
Chemistry, you know, having each other's back. Then there's lastly, identity. Who are we? Winning teams have a sense of who they are. That's who we are. They do something well, and they acknowledge it. That's who we are. And, you know, it's been said that winning teams define themselves by a standard of excellence. We're committed to performing at a certain level. That's who we are. So those would be the nine keys: purpose, talent, leadership, strategy, commitment, feedback, confidence, chemistry, and identity.
Of the nine, how many do you need to do to be successful?
It's a very good question, George. I think there's so many different ways you can cook the cake, mix up these ingredients. I would say, that's a tough question. I would say it's great if you can embrace all of them.
Sure. But,
I mean, and to some extent you do. I mean, you know, you set, it's funny, we're talking about meaningful purpose, for example. I was asked one time, there was a professional hockey team in Vancouver where I am at the moment, and they were struggling, and the press went to the coach, and they asked the coach, could you do more to motivate the team? And the coach was an old school guy at the time, and he said, it's not my job to motivate the team. And what he was thinking, I think, was that we pay these guys millions of dollars to play. I shouldn't have to be a cheerleader. But the press thought it was an unusual remark, as I did, and they came to me and they said, what do you think of what he said? And I said, I understand where he was coming from, but I don't agree. Whether it's the boardroom or the locker room, the manager, the coach, the leader has the ability to open a window in people's minds about what is possible. And if people get a sense that something extraordinary is possible, they are going to work harder to make it happen, because healthy people want to excel.
Can you have these nine ingredients, these nine possibilities, and still have problems like you can't take criticism, you're paranoid, and things like that? Does that offset these nine if you have that ability?
Well, I think as a player, there's ways of dealing with that kind of thing. But certainly if you have several players on the team who don't buy in or who have a great deal of self-doubt, it's going to impact on team performance. So, there's things that oftentimes coaches will do things if they're players who aren't buying in. I think the first thing you do is you sit down and you say, what's going on? Sometimes a player doesn't perceive that the role that they're being asked to perform is the role they should be playing. And sometimes there has to be a little more explanation. I had a player once say to me, what he's asking me to do, I've been told my whole career not to do it, and I'm not going to do it. Because if I do that, I'm going to look like a fool, not him. So I can go back to the coach. I'm not going to throw the player under the bus, but
right.
I'm going to say, I think you have to explain to him why this is important. He's not getting it. And once the player gets a better explanation, sometimes he buys in. Sometimes he doesn't. If he doesn't, the next thing the coach often does is say, well, I think you should just sit and observe. And if he still doesn't get it, because players want to play, they don't want to watch, then, you know, in sport, you can trade them. You can release them. You can't quite do that in some other areas.
What happens, Dr. Miller, to a country if our leadership looks at these nine points and say, Let's analyze these. Are we meaningful as a country? Do we have talented people in the administration or wherever? Are we leaders? Do we have a strategy? Are we committed to make these things happen? And all the way down your list, if we do that as a country, what have we done?
Well, I think it would be very effective. I mean, a country, in a sense, we can see America as a great team. And certainly, we want to have a meaningful purpose. I think that's a tragedy in these times, frankly, because there's so much divisiveness. There's so much polarization.
Yeah, we're disjointed right now.
Absolutely. I mean, if you had a team where half the players were pulling in one direction and half in another direction, absolutely, no matter how much talent you had on both sides, you'd severely impact performance negatively. And it's interesting, if I'm on the program right now and I say something positive about the president, 40% of the listeners are going to be upset.
Yes, I get that in my emails. You're going to love this. I have two individuals that I've been relying on during these impeachment inquiries. Mm-hmm. And one is pro-President Trump. The other is obviously not. Mm-hmm. One is a Democrat. One is a Republican. So on one day, sometimes I'll have them both on the same day. But on one day, I'll have the pro-President Trump person on. And I get all these hate mails about him from those that don't like him. And then the next day, I'll have the anti-President Trump guy on. And I get all the pro-President Trump people that come on. I mean,
You can't win, George. And what somebody was saying earlier about the situation with GM, with labor and management.
Right.
I mean, I'm called in by management. And really, in a sense, they're the same team. I mean, I understand the different management's a team and labor's a team, but they're working in the same industry. And so often they're pulling in opposite directions and really negatively impacting on the whole industry. So I think if people could really buy into meaningful purpose, and that's a key leadership thing. Leadership has the capacity to enroll disparate groups in a similar direction. I mean, in former Yugoslavia, they talk about what Tito did during the war. And we see subsequent to that how that whole area, that region, just split off into three pieces. But
yep.
He had that ability to pull these pieces together. And I think one of the tragedies in American politics really was when Kennedy was assassinated.
Oh, we've never been the same since. I was 13, but this country's been wounded and limping ever since.
Because he had the ability as a coach, as a leader, to say, don't ask what the country can do for you. Ask what you can do for the country. And people bought in. And when he said we're going to get a man on the moon in 10 years,
he did it.
People bought in. And if we went into that Houston Space Center and we looked at the people in that room, whether they were Republicans or Democrats, it didn't matter. They were all dialed in to making something happen. And we just don't see that today.
Well, and one of the things I would do, too, if I were in that chair, I would say, I am going to find the best people for my cabinet. I don't care if they're Republicans, Democrats, Libertarians. I'm going to get the best person I can find for that job and do it.
Yeah. Well, I think, George, that's one of the things about sport and pretty much the same with business. I mean, there's some nepotism there. But in sport, people are absolutely out there prospecting for the best talent. And, they're going to do what they can to provide the best coaches to coach this talent. And it's interesting, one of the differences between sport and business and politics is that in sport, there's a pretty clear, fast bottom line. We can determine if a team is winning or not. In business, there's a bottom line. We may have to wait for a quarterly report. But in sport, we know. Somebody once said that the box score is the truest thing in the newspaper, because we can know that...
In black and white.
Exactly. We know today he went 2-for-4 at the plate, or we know exactly what he did. In politics, unfortunately, the spin is the game. And you get, when we see the Democratic debates, I mean, in a sense, it's a team, but everybody's up there spinning. They all did everything wonderful over the year. I mean, there's no accountability for what people actually did, which we see in sport, and that's why I love working with it, and we see it in business.
We're with Dr. Saul Miller. How can a parent or parents use these techniques on their children to make them great adults?
Well, that's a good question. Mostly, you know, these days I'm working pretty much, I say, before, I don't work with people much younger than 12 or 13, all the way up to the highest levels and the best teams and best, the Olympics and professional sport. But with youngsters, I think the first and foremost thing is to love them and support them.
Yes.
And to be talking to them, to get them to say some positive things to themselves. I work with self-talk. A lot of people do.
And quit putting them down for everything.
Absolutely. I mean, I think accountability is useful, but I mean, it's like saying when somebody does something poorly, it's saying to them, that's not who you are. That tells them that what they did wasn't successful and they're capable of more. And when they do something well, it's saying to them, that's who you are. That's who we are. And I work a little bit, well, I work quite a bit with imagery. And with youngsters, they buy into imagery. You know, I can ask a professional athlete, an NFL player, a Major League Baseball player, to pick an animal that gives them the feelings they'd want to have on the field, on the court, on the ice. And it's interesting, George, 99.9% are picking predators. They're picking tigers, lions, cheetahs, wolves, bears. They're picking predators. And I said, the difference between predators and prey is that the predator steps out to make something happen. The prey doesn't want to make a mistake. And with kids, you can do the same. Pick an animal that would give you the feeling, and they'll pick. Kids sometimes pick some strange animals.
Yeah, yeah.
Usually they're picking the same. They're picking tigers and lions. And I say to them, you know, the tiger loves to hunt. So go out there and really love to be the best you can be. And when they don't do well, we say, hey, that's okay. Take a breath. I work a lot with getting kids to just take a breath and move on to the next thing. But you're right. If we're hypercritical of children, then they become fearful. They become prey.
That's right.
Don't make a mistake.
Exactly. And they won't take chances.
They won't take chances, and their love for the activity is diminished.
Let me ask you this. This is going to be a bizarre question, but there's a reason behind this. Of these 9 traits, how many of them do you think Hitler was very successful with?
Well,
I think he had a lot of them. As sick as he was.
Yeah. He
had a meaningful purpose.
Purpose, yes, he did. He, you know, he was a strong leader in a bizarre way. He had a game plan. He had a strategy. I mean, he was committed to insanity.
He was confident.
And, yeah, I mean, there was...
He didn't have chemistry.
Well, I imagine within the... You know, that
the party
leadership group that existed, there was unanimity of mind.
All right, but with these 9 traits, of which let's say he had many of them, where did he go wrong? Besides being insane and killing people.
Well, I think that's where he went wrong, George. I mean, what they were trying to do was against the value, what was against the core human values. And in that sense, I mean...
It backfired.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's a whole other thing. Maybe we can talk about that at some point, because one of the tragedies I see today in North America, I'm here in Canada, it's the same, are the eroding values that people have.
All right. Hold on, Dr. Miller. We'll talk about that when we come back, and we'll take phone calls next hour with you as well, and there will be many. Here's our next emerging artist. Rick Purcell from Martindale, Texas. The song is called Another Night, and as you know, we highlight emerging artists every first Sunday.